Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, I'm Linda Ellerby. I was diagnosed with breast cancer 11 years ago, and I know how scary it can be. Everything your doctor says sounds like a foreign language. HER2-new, oncogene, ductal carcinoma in situ. What do these words mean? How can you decide what to do if you can't even say what you have? Go to breastcancer.org, a special place on the Internet where you can learn how to say those words and find out what they mean. Breastcancer.org, the first place to go the minute you find out you have breast cancer.
Good morning, and welcome to Saturday Mornings with Joy Keyes. I'm your host, Joy Keyes. I want to thank you so much for tuning in. You can follow me on Twitter.com/Joy Keyes, and you can become a fan on Facebook. Just look up Saturday Mornings with Joy Keyes. Also, send me an email. I would love to hear from you. My email address is SaturdaysWithJoyKeyes@Hotmail.com. First, I just want to say thank you so much for listening to the show. A past 700,000 downloads of the show could not have done that without your support. Really appreciate it. I hope you have enjoyed the shows and shared them with friends and family. Again, I just want to say thank you so much for your support. Well, this morning I have a wonderful author who actually took me back to school. I feel like after reading the book, I just had a class in genetics and biology, chemistry. I took three classes in one. I mean, if you ever need to take these classes, just show your teacher this book and you'll probably pass. The book is called The Philadelphia Chromosome, and it's by Jessica Wapner. Good morning, Jessica.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for calling in today.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
I just want to read a little bit. This is from right at the beginning of your book, The Chromosome and the Disease. This is part one. In 1959, the blood-based cancer known as chronic myeloid leukemia was universally fatal. Even when the disease was diagnosed in its earliest stages, most patients died within 6 years. The sole treatment, radiotherapy for the spleen, did little to improve the odds. Several decades later, treatments were still inadequate. Drugs gave many patients an extra few years, but eventually the malignancy became unmanageable. So that was 1959. Here we are in 2013, and there's a pill. So let's start off with you and the scientific writing, because like I mentioned, I feel like I went to school and I took three classes. I mean, how did you get into this, you know, genre of the scientific writing?
Well, it started probably in about the year 2000. I mean, I had studied biology in college, but I spent 4 years studying mockingbirds mostly. I was not studying molecular biology at all. Excuse me. And in around the year 2000, I started working at a medical journal on cancer research and treatment. And it kind of took off from there. I was editing material about cancer and learning about drug development and learning about this thing called the Philadelphia chromosome. Later, I became a freelance writer and on a full-time basis. And that was when I, you know, started investigating the story more. And I knew that this was, you know, an incredible untold story. But to tell the story, you know, required learning about viruses and the connection between viruses and cancer in animals because of how the research led to our understandings of cancer in humans. The chemistry, like you mentioned, which is what, that was one of my favorite parts of the book, was learning about how a drug actually gets made. What is the physical process to string together these compounds in the hope that they will be able to slip inside a cell and block the root cause of cancer inside a blood cell? So it was, you know, for me, it was an education also as I was writing it, which was great. And then the challenge of finding ways to convey the research in a way that would be engaging and fun and interesting, where you come out of it feeling like, yeah, you have such a better grasp of what goes on behind the scenes, but also this human story underneath it all.
Yeah, and, you know, there's many human stories. There's the human story, I think when people say that first, they think about the person that has the cancer. But there's the human story of the researchers also that I think you spelled out very eloquently, and some parts were very sad. I mean, at the beginning, for example, Noel and Hungerford, and then yeah. Hungerford didn't make it. And I was like, oh, I was like, you know, reading this, like, watching a movie, and then you're like, yay, they discovered this, and okay, and then he died. I was like, wait a second, whoa, I'm only at chapter, like, 2 or 3, and he died? What are you doing to me? Like, is that a mistake? I was like, huh? Let me go back. Did you say he did what? And he, oh, my God, no. You know, I was like, you kind of messed me up there, Jessica, because I really actually had to go back and say, did I read that right, that he's dead? Okay. And he died of cancer. Hungerford
died.
That's
right. He died of lung cancer. He was a lifelong smoker, and he died of lung cancer. And he also suffered from multiple sclerosis, and he kept it hidden from his colleagues because he was a private person. He didn't want anybody to know that he was suffering because he thought that they would pity him and then treat him differently in his research environment. And they ended up, as I write about in the book, they shut down his lab because he had become so unproductive. And nobody knew why. But now Fox Chase Cancer Center in Philadelphia, which is where he was researching, honors him. And actually, they're hosting me to do a talk at the launch of the book on Tuesday. And his wife, Alice Hungerford, is an incredible force of nature, preserving his history. And I mean, she has every paper he's ever written, and every scrap of paper he's ever written. You know, not just every journal citation. She's an incredible champion of his memory. She was very helpful to me with writing that part of the story.
Well, I was just saddened, and it kind of threw me like, wait a second. You know, I was really happy. I'm like, okay, I'm reading this book, and okay, these guys discovered this, and okay, great, you know. And I mean, I kind of knew the end already, so I was like, okay. But, you know, that kind of threw me. Another, you know, story that dealing with the researcher aspect is how long. That was in the 1950s. Like we said, it's 2013. Like there was one guy, I cannot remember his name, but he was like at 6 years of studying one aspect, and then he was about to give up, and then finally at the seventh year, he discovered some aspect that helped, you know, took it to the next level. You know, that's Erickson, I think his name was.
That's
Erickson?
That's right, yeah. Very good. You get a gold star.
I got some little markers and dashes going on in your book. Probably, I can't resell this book. Let's put it that way.
it's Ray Erickson, right?
Yeah, that's
sorry,
a big
what?
Issue because that's a big issue of how long it takes to make a discovery, also then how quickly a discovery can be made, and then the third issue is this pressure on researchers. You're not making any discoveries, we're not going to fund you. But that's a perfect example that it could take 7, 8 years, 10, well, literally 18 years to get to the pill. You know, who is deciding to dole out this money from the government, from these, you know, places, and how much politics do you see getting intermingled with these research centers? You know what I mean? Like,
such great questions. I mean, the landscape of research is so different from when Ray Erickson, who you talk about, was researching this aspect of cancer. His discovery was totally seminal to the eventual creation of this drug called Gleevec. He wasn't studying chronic myeloid leukemia, but he discovered a protein called a kinase, which was driving cancer in another form of cancer. So his attention shed light, his research shed light on these proteins known as kinases and the role that they could play in driving cancer. It was eventually a kinase that was found to be the culprit in chronic myeloid leukemia. And of course, you read all about the connection between the Philadelphia chromosome and the kinase and chronic myeloid leukemia, and then the creation of the kinase inhibitor, which is the kind of drug that Gleevec is. that research, as you said, took 7 years. His work took 7 years, and he's beginning to worry, like, I've got this lab of postdoc researchers here. I'm not going to be able to keep funding them. I'm going to have to let them go because this, you know, the research isn't going anywhere. But at the same time, there was a pressure of, you know, the publish or perish pressure did exist then, but not to the extent that it does today. Peter Knoll, one of the discoverers of the Philadelphia chromosome, had lifelong funding from the National Institutes of Health, which meant he never had to lock his office door to write a grant application.
I thought that was so amazing. I was like, that was another thing that I was like, really? How did he do that? Who did he know? I mean, that was just like nowadays unheard of, you know, to have that capability to not have to stress because, again, it just goes back to how long it could take, and even though some things happen instantaneously, like, for example, we start out the book with chickens. It's from chickens, you know, a chicken virus. Then we go into mice. And then there was actually, it wasn't even the head researcher. It was a student who came upon the connection of the human, because at the point it wasn't really proven that the virus caused the cancer. You know what I mean? Like, there wasn't the connection between the humans yet. It was a
That's
student.
Right.
A postdoc who was working for someone. I don't know. Who was the guy he was working for?
He was working for a scientist called Owen Witte.
Witte, yes.
He's currently on the President's Cancer Panel right now. Owen Witte, he's at UCLA in California.
So that was interesting, too. He wasn't even like a bigwig. He was like, I'll say, random student, you know, but a different set of eyes is so important. And that's one of the things your book shows is the different sections all brought together at the end that actually helped the drug. Because some people had specialties in one area, some, like you didn't even, like you said, you didn't start out knowing this information. You were studying mockingbirds, and then you had to learn. So we need a multidisciplinary team.
Yes. The way I always think of it is, I think of it as we fund curiosity, right? We don't fund end results. We fund questions. And there's, you know, such a demand to fund the answer, right, which I get. I understand, and I, you know, I would want funding for answers too. But I just, my impression after, you know, researching this story, investigating this story was wow, you know, these were just people who were asking the right question at the right time, and all of those questions put together in one experiment at a time eventually created this tapestry of revolutionary understanding about how cancer forms and led to the creation of one of the most successful cancer drugs ever made, a pill that a patient can take once a day that has no side effects or very few side effects and that will allow you to live a long, healthy life. I mean, that's science fiction. And it exists.
Well, let me just read a part of your book because some people may be saying, like, well, okay, so isn't that like people do that all the time now with genetics and diseases? But in the book it talks about that, you know, breast cancer drug tamoxifen was really the first targeted drug because it works by specifically blocking the production of estrogen. The difference, said Klausner, responding to a question from a journalist, is that the estrogen receptor targeted by tamoxifen is not the root cause of cancer. That's the key word, root cause. CML is a one-gene disease. A single mutant gene encodes a single mutant enzyme, and this enzyme alone causes cancer. So this is the key difference, that you are stopping at the root before it even, like, gets into the wound. You're like, whoa, you can't come in here. Don't even think about it. Don't even think about proliferating throughout body, this human system. And there are lots of different diseases that have, a single gene that makes them happen. Sickle cell anemia, cystic fibrosis, Huntington's disease. What do you know about other companies' business, like lupus, multiple sclerosis, people working on are these things considered single cell caused by a single gene? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
What is your knowledge about other areas, other diseases and stuff?
Well, I mean, my knowledge at the moment is really heavily on cancer research and where
mm-hmm.
that is in terms of understanding the genetic underpinnings of it. And what happens in cancer is that, you know, the reason why chronic myeloid leukemia, why this story is so important, well, for many reasons, but one reason is because it proves the principle that you could create a drug to target these underlying causes, right?
Mm-hmm.
So before that, there was nobody knew if it was even possible, right? Because making a chemical to block a single tiny mechanism inside a cell just seems, you know, kind of impossible.
They didn't even have the technology to see. I mean, that was another issue, too, and that's why funding is so important, that people can't dream about something that they're not aware of, can't
mm-hmm.
fulfill the dream if they don't have the right tools to manifest. You know, so that was a really big issue also in the development, is that the length of time that it took for them to separate different things and dyes and different types of processes.
Mm-hmm.
Nowadays, it's like boom, 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 you know, like snap your finger and you probably have a machine. But in 1960, you know, that wasn't the case, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah,
that's
there
another
was no
issue.
History. The history did not exist. And that's still the case with this drug, is every day that, you know, the earliest patients are still alive is another day in the experiment. You know, it's still going on to see how, you know, how long is this drug going to work for, how many people, how is it, you know, can we make other ones just like it? It's still, we're living the research, really.
Well, one of the things I talked to you right before we came on the air is this issue of almost a pharmaceutical mafia. Because one of the things I read that didn't surprise me is what they call evergreening, I think it was called. They're paying off other companies. So they came up with Gleevec. Great. Wow, lots of money. They were going to charge crazy amounts of money, like $2,000 a month for somebody to take this. Who can afford $2,000 a month, first of all? That's like the person who's sick, lost their job, is not wealthy probably. They're sick, and then you want them to pay $2,000 a month for a drug? Really? Okay. That was my first annoyance. The second annoyance was generic types come out, and then the original, the name brand loses value. So companies were paying other companies not to release their drug.
Yeah, well, evergreening.
That's like making me really mad, Jessica.
Yeah, no, I know. It's a good way to, when you feel like getting your dander up about something, just turn your mind to evergreening. Evergreening is a whole host of practices by which pharmaceutical companies extend the life of a patent. Because as you said, when a patent expires, it's what they call it, the patent cliff. A drug loses 90% or more of its volume, right? So nobody, once there's a generic version, nobody is buying the brand name anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And sales just drop abruptly, like to the day the patent expires. Excuse me. So the evergreening is, I mean, my goodness, there's all kinds of things. You see a company might change tinker with the chemical formula ever so
mm-hmm.
slightly, in a way that doesn't really change anything about the drug. There's nothing really innovative about the change, but now it's a different chemical, so it deserves a, you know, new patent or extension on the patent, or the dosage might change a tiny bit. I remember hearing once, and I keep meaning to track down the exact facts behind this one, that that there was an instance where a company said that, well, once you swallow a pill, the chemical changes, and they were going to patent the chemical that it changes to inside your body.
What?
Yeah, I've,
what?
I and
oh
I,
my
you
God.
Know, I know it's so outlandish. I really have to check that one out. And then, that one that you just cited, where a generic where a pharmaceutical company, the brand name company, would pay the generic manufacturer sum of money to say, well, wait a year. Because that's like, say they, if they pay the generic manufacturer $1 million, and I'm making that number up, $1 million, well, the brand name maker could be making $2 million in sales from the drug.
Mm-hmm.
So if they
yeah.
still earn more money, I mean, you can make a huge amount of money from a drug in a 1 year. So evergreening is a big deal. It's a big problem. And probably
another thing the problem was that I forgot the scientist, but he was working at Novartis and he was trying to, some people could not take Gleevec. It didn't really help them. They took it stopped the progression, and then all of a sudden they spiked again. So one of the scientists was trying to come up with another drug, and the marketing department and Novartis was like,
uh-huh.
No, don't tell anybody that you're coming up with another drug, because then they're going to think that the first one doesn't work.
That's right.
And I was like, I was another section. I had to flip back and say, what? I had a guy on here about the history of cigarettes and marketing of cigarettes and the whole cigarette industry. And just people do not realize the backdrop. Like, they only see the nice, shiny item. They don't realize what went into this nice, shiny item and what went into getting you to take it and what went into getting you not to take something else. Like, how much choice did we really have? Our choices are already being made for us because somebody over here to the left wants to make a lot of money. So they're going to stop you from seeing any other choices other than this one. So it was saddening, but they did come out. So there's two types now of this drug that inhibits, because some people were resistant. And that was a really nice story. There was a young man. You had a picture, I think, of the guy in there. Was that the other guy? No.
That's the origin. That's the man I write about in the prologue. But there was
a man in
Seattle named Hans Lowland, who's actually going to speak with me. He's going to join me in a discussion when I go to Seattle in early June. And he and his wife have had a child since he's had this disease. And
Yes.
That's an issue, too.
What's going to happen to his kid? What's going to happen to his kid? Because he's on this drug, so that's another issue for research. Children of these people. So.
They're safe. You know, the child is safe, and everybody is. It was a perfectly, you know, everything was okay. But his story was amazing because, you know, CML, the disease we're talking about, is rare. It's diagnosed in 5,000 people in the U.S. each year, about 5,000. And it turned out that his best friend had the same disease.
Right. That was
totally
And then I was thinking about environmental issues. Environmental issues, because that's another thing. You know, there's genetic, and then there's genetic and environment, and then there's, like, the trigger of, you know, well, somebody could have this gene, but nothing happens, but then they're in a specific environment, and then boom. You know, like people living near the high electrical wiring and all this stuff, you know. And then, so it's just amazing. I really appreciated the book, and I think that a lot of people will actually enjoy reading it. I mean, nerdy people. I'm a nerd, Jessica. Sorry.
The idea was that, I mean, I get that way too. I love a good trip to Geekville. but also there's this human story, and that was, for me, like, the science and the medicine is fascinating. I love to know about it. I think that if we're going to discuss as a society healthcare and how drugs should be made, I think this story is essential reading. We have to equip ourselves with knowledge. But there's also this human story. There's this incredible story of heroism in getting this drug made. Where the
and women were involved too. I want to give a shout out to women. I'm glad that you highlighted the women that helped along the path, because a lot of times you just see pictures of all these, like, you know, guys in their white suits, so to speak. And there were several women that I was really happy to read about that were involved. And that's an issue for clinical trials, though. Who's getting into clinical trials? Because for minorities, for women, drugs that are being given to women are being tested on men. They're not just being tested on women. Drugs for African American that you know, are being tested on all white people. So it's like, who's getting in the clinical trials, and then who's actually going to be taking the drug?
Yeah, sometimes you find a clinical trial is enrolling patients who are the least likely to experience problems with the drug.
Right.
You know,
right.
So it helps make the drug look better than it might in the actual disease population. But that's, you know, that's not the norm. I mean, that's, you know, that's not the preponderance of clinical trials, but that does happen.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I'm going to be giving away some copies of your book, The Philadelphia Chromosome, by Jessica Wapner. You can check out her website, jessicawapner.com. She's also on Twitter, at Jessica Wapner. I think it was a great book. How long did it take you to write the book?
I wrote this book I wrote the first draft in about 6 months, and overall it was about a year. I was researching it for several years, but the writing was mostly done over a year.
Wow. Well, you did a great job, and I'm a nerd, but I think it will be easy for people to understand. But it's also helpful, like you said, that we have more books like this because people need to see the backside and also the human side and the benefit, not just the money. You know, unfortunately, the money can be the evil pull, I guess, but the purpose is to cure people. And it's not cured. Let's get that straight. This disease is not cured.
That's right.
Because people did go off the pill. Mm-hmm. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no, if people stop taking this medication, then the disease is very likely to return.
Yeah. So that's we're still on the path to fighting. But I think it was a great leap, and it made a lot of people's lives so much, you know, better, especially the young man in Seattle that had the baby. I mean, wow, you know, that's like he was thought he was going to be dead in like 5 or 6 years.
Yeah, there's so many people. I have that picture of LaDonna LaPasa, who was, you know, really, she was being pushed into the clinical trial.
She was at the end stage. Yeah.
She had chosen her burial plot before she got into this clinical trial, and now she's still alive. 10 years later, she's alive.
That's great. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you
Jessica.
So much. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
Well, thank you, and you guys, you have a wonderful Saturday. And what is your thing public on Tuesday at Fox Chase? Can anybody come, or is that a private event?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's Fox Chase Cancer Center is an open event, and I have a lot of different talks coming up in D.C., others in Philadelphia at Free Library, Portland, Seattle, Texas, in New York City. I'll be at the World Science Festival speaking at their Meet the Authors session. So all kinds of places. It's all on my website, and the book is available through all the usual channels.
Wonderful. So check out JessicaWapner.com and follow her on Twitter at Jessica Wapner. You have a great Saturday.
Thanks so much. Okay. So great to talk with you.
Nice speaking with you. Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you, everybody, for tuning in. I just got off the phone with author Jessica Wapner. Her book, The Philadelphia Chromosome, A Mutant Gene and the Quest to Cure Cancer at the Genetic Level. I'll be giving away some copies of that book, so follow me at Joy Keys or become a fan on Facebook. Also, you can send me an email, but in order to win the book, you got to follow or become a fan. Stay tuned. In a couple minutes, I'll be speaking with Layla Moreno. She's a lupus advocate, and Annette Myrick, who's the CEO of Lupus Foundation Tri-State Chapter, about living with lupus. Thank you so much for tuning in.
Hi, I'm Linda Ellerbe. I was diagnosed with breast cancer 11 years ago, and I know how scary it can be. Everything your doctor says sounds like a foreign language. HER2-new, oncogene, ductal carcinoma in situ. What do these words mean? How can you decide what to do if you can't even say what you have? Go to breastcancer.org, a special place on the Internet where you can learn how to say those words and find out what they mean. Breastcancer.org, the first place to go the minute you find out you have breast cancer.